This is Castro versus State. Our number is 56763. If counselor ready to proceed, please do so. Please state your name for the record and if you wish to reserve any time.
Good morning. My name is David Lopez McReady. May it please the court, I represent the appellant Martin Castro. I will be asking to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. When looking at this case, it struck me, one, as an instance of governmental prosecutorial overreaching, overcharging a kidnapping count when it's merely incidental to a robbery or a sexual assault, seeking to admit my client's confession while he's recovering from multiple surgeries after receiving gunshot wounds, still in the intensive care unit at the hospital, and then proliferating additional charges based on a single course of conduct.
Well, if I understand the facts, and correct me if I'm wrong, he broke into the house when they were having the barbecue, the two men and the two women,
yes.
And that there was a gun pulled, a robbery took place, the people were told to move or hit with the gun, the shotgun, I think if I understand correctly, were hit with it and they were moved with it. And then there was the sexual assault with the barrel of the shotgun upon the women.
Right. My understanding of the facts, however, are not that they hit them to move them. As soon as they entered the house, they basically came in with the guns drawn and told everyone to get down on the ground. At that point then, four victims at that point get down on the ground and stay there. And they're immobile at that point. Now, there are these charges where the state is lodging for supposedly my client hitting them on the head, telling them to shut up and that kind of thing. But during the whole course of this incident, they stayed in that one room in the kitchen, which by testimony was very small. And they were there in that confined space. But in this case, all of this was incidental to the robbery. It was not a standalone kidnapping charge. Under this court's precedent of Mendoza, it states that, you know, double punishment for kidnapping is inappropriate if the movement or restraint is merely incidental and does not substantially increase the risk of harm above that already present in the associated crime, and also does not substantially exceed the movement required to complete that associated crime. Dual convictions are permissible only if the movement or restraint stands alone with independent significance, okay? And in the clearest cases, this is a question of law, not fact. Now, there are cases when these kidnappings have been reversed. If we look at Jefferson, which Mendoza clarified, in that case, the defendant went ahead and robbed a store clerk with a gun, took money from the register, forced the clerk to the back room, made her undress, lie on her stomach on the ground, warned her that he would shoot her if she came outside, and then went in and started rifling through the drawers for more money. That kidnapping was reversed. The movement from the counter to the back room was not anything required beyond that for the actual robbery. In Wright, also the kidnapping was reversed. And there were three defendants that rob a motel, again with guns. After they take the money from the register, they move the victims 20 to 40 feet to the back office. At that point, they make them lay down, and they even tape them hand and foot. Then the victims threaten them. The entire episode lasts 3 to 5 minutes. The kidnapping was incidental because the detention was only for the short amount of time required to complete the robbery. This court said that if we literally apply the kidnapping statute, it would be difficult to conceive how any robbery could be completed without also a kidnapping. Now, obviously, there are cases where a standalone kidnapping charge is proper. And we have cases such as Pasqua. In that case, defendants robbed the victim in the kitchen of his wallet. They also made him give them the combination to his safe. Then they asked him to disclose information about a sportsbook ticket. When he refused to do that, they moved him to the bedroom, put him on the bed. They climbed on him, or the defendant climbed on him. And there was evidence that they may have tied him down, and then they started choking him with caulking in the nostrils and in the mouth, while the accomplice was striking him with a hammer. The victim died. The kidnapping was proper in that case. It was also a concern of this court that when dealing with the charge of sexual assault, there is a movement that's inherent in that charge as well. And because of that, there is a concern that every sexual assault would also be a kidnapping under Nolan v. State. There are cases where dual convictions, again, are proper. And if we look at Nolan, at that point, the defendant met the victim in the bar. Then he drugs her. And then he coerces her into a street and then pulls her into an apartment where then she was raped. We look at Doyle v. State. That's another case where the kidnapping stood alone.
Now, was there evidence that when the victims were lying down, if they raised their heads, they whacked him with the shotgun as they moved up or attempted to raise their heads? Was that part of the evidence of the trial?
I think that there may have been some evidence of that, whether they were raising their head or prying or speaking back to the defendant, that there was some hitting of the head. However, that kind of leads me into an argument about some of these charges are redundant. Okay. And in that case, we're talking about this one single course of conduct, them coming in, robbing the victims, making them stay down there, and basically either going through one of the victim's purse to get the cell phone and any cash, or going through another victim's pockets and getting cash. And there's also testimony that as soon as they walked in, they started to frisk one of the victims, Carolyn. This was all part of the robbery. And in order to effectuate the robbery, obviously they made them get down. So I think that the hitting on the head is a redundant charge of effectuating the robbery. When we're looking at what stands as a redundant charge, you know, this court obviously follows the Fifth Amendment that prohibits a second trial for one offense or multiple punishments for one offense. We utilize the Blockberger test, where if there are different elements for each case, for each offense, then...
Counsel, you kind of stayed away from that point. You argued redundancy. You didn't really get into this area that you're about to go down now.
I should not get into it?
Well, I'm just saying you kind of stayed away from it in your briefing.
Did you argue double jeopardy, or did you just argue redundancy?
We definitely argued double jeopardy. We definitely cited the Fifth Amendment as the basis for redundant convictions. And also the trial attorneys moved to dismiss these counts after trial. They filed a separate motion to do that. So I believe the issue is definitely preserved in that regard. And obviously this court, talking about how you decide if a charge is redundant, you know, one of the cases interpreting this line of inquiry is Albiter v. State, right? Mm-hmm. It has great language in there. It says the legislature never intended to permit the state to proliferate charges as to one course of conduct by adorning it with chameleonic attire, right? So first we're looking at the legislative intent, and then we conduct a case-by-case analysis. And this is something that the Eighth Circuit is doing in the case U.S. v. Chips, where basically you're asking if the legislature intended each underlying count to be a separate unit of prosecution. Did the violations arise from a singleness of thought, purpose, or action, which comprised a single impulse? Okay. And then we have case law here in our state, Wilson v. State, where the defendant's conduct of taking four photographs of a minor in various stages of undress constituted only a single act instead of four, overturning redundant convictions. And then again in Albitre, there were four convictions involving two counts of involuntary manslaughter and then two counts of causing the death of another by reckless driving. Those were overturned as redundant of the two DUI deaths already. In that case, court had good language saying the state had simply compounded the convictions by eliminating the aspect of alcohol, okay? And then we look at Salazar, another case that is relevant to this type of inquiry. There, It was a battery with a deadly weapon charge and a mayhem charge. They were both from the same conduct, though, where the defendant cut the victim with a box cutter, causing permanent nerve damage. The court said that the battery charge, I think the mayhem charge, was redundant. It was one illegal act. And in this case, we're looking at these battery counts, battery with a deadly weapon, and battery with intent to commit sexual assault, as redundant of the robbery or as redundant of the sexual assault. And specifically, regarding the sexual assault, we have these open and gross lewdness convictions, counts 20 to 23, that are merely incidental to the actual penetration that later takes place, or the attempted penetration.
Was there some touching, though, that took place there, independent of the shotgun incident?
Yes, there was evidence of touching, of groping, or...
Wouldn't that be open and gross lewdness? Wouldn't that sustain the convictions,
Your Honor,
for those?
I would say no, because under Townsend v. State, and also Crowley and Ebeling, we're talking about cases that distinguish acts that predispose the final sexual assault. And in this case, this is exactly what's happening. The victims are being touched and fondled, their pants are being drawn down, and then is the penetration, either by finger or by the firearm. So this is just conduct that is predisposing a prelude to the actual penetration. So that's why those counts are also redundant. And that's basically the situation on those issues. Now, going back to the kidnapping, we have here a situation where the defendants may be victims basically stay in one room in the kitchen and stay there the whole time. They were immobile the whole time. They were not moved upstairs. In fact, the defendant, an accomplice that went upstairs to rob or look for money and then came back downstairs, they would trade on and off. The victims, again, were staying right there. They were not moved. They were not even bound or tied in any way restrained. And that's basically what happened in this case. So under the cases that we have before us, and
Counsel,
the facts...
you're at the three-minute mark. If you wish to reserve any time, you need to...
I will think about this one. Thank you.
We have to save.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jake Murbach. I represent the state of Nevada in this case. The appellant has raised nine different issues, and I will also begin with the kidnapping issue. There are four separate kidnapping counts. There are 3, 4, 5, and 6, one for each of the victims in the case, Janae, Damien, Nasario, and Caroline. None of the kidnapping counts in this case were incidental under three of the five Mendoza factors. This is obviously a very fact-specific analysis under the Mendoza case, and the jury in this case was properly instructed under Mendoza. And I'd first like to talk about factor number two, which is that any incidental movement of the victim substantially increased the risk of harm to the victim over and above that necessarily present in the underlying offense. And as Justice Gibbons pointed out, in this case, there are facts that each of the victims raise their heads. Once they're on the ground, they raise their heads, and as they raise their heads to look up, the barrel of the shotgun is used to hit them in the head and push them back down.
Is that the anticipated movement that the court has perceived in the past?
I clearly believe that that type of movement, when you have a shotgun being used to push someone's head back down, it's incidental. I would agree with the court that it's incidental movement, but it clearly increases the risk of harm. Their head could have been hurt.
Movement that we usually have been considering is moving from place to place.
And I understand that type of movement, and I'm not disagreeing that this movement isn't quite incidental. The argument I'm making, Your Honor, is that it clearly increases the risk of harm, which is the analysis done under that second Mendoza factor. These actions were not necessary for the completion of the robbery or for the sexual assault, and there are few things that would increase the risk of harm in the same way as hitting someone's head down with the barrel of a shotgun would. The other factor four, is that the victim was physically restrained, and such restraint substantially increased the risk of harm to the victim. All four of the victims in this case were held at gunpoint on the ground, with shotguns being pointed at them, being used to push them back down. This constituted physical restraint of the victims, keeping them on the ground, not letting them get up, Their restraint clearly increased the risk of harm, as the fourth Mendoza factor requires. Once again, the pointing of the shotgun is clearly an increased risk of harm. They could have been injured. The gun could have gone off. So I think that on the facts of this case, the state has also met the non-incidental test under the fourth Mendoza factor. And then finally, the fifth Mendoza factor, the movement or restraint had an independent purpose or significance. All the victims were ordered on the ground, held down at gunpoint. Clearly, this had independent purpose to ensure that they couldn't look up, couldn't see what was going on, to ensure that they couldn't get away, that they couldn't get help. So I understand the court's concern in regards to some of the prior cases that were mentioned by opposing counsel in regards to the length of the movement, but these are obviously very fact-specific analyses that the court is doing, and the state would submit that clearly under the facts of this case, three of the five Mendoza factors are met. And then finally, I would just like to point out the holding in the Langford case, Langford versus State, where the court held that whether the movement of the victim was incidental to the associated offense and whether the movement increased the risk of harm to the victim are questions of fact to be determined by the jury in all but the clearest of cases. And the state would submit that here, that this is not one of those cases. This is one of those cases where clearly three of the five Mendoza factors are met. In regards to the duplicative charges that counsel just argued, Justice Douglas pointed out that this is really not a Blockberger argument. The appellant's brief doesn't really address the elements test that Blockberger contains. Really, this is a redundancy or a duplicative argument. And the redundancy analysis really goes to whether the legislature intended to punish these acts separately. Each count in this case punishes a distinct and separate act. The gravamen of each charged act is separate. And I'm going to address the three different redundancy arguments that the appellant groups the redundancy arguments into three different groups. First, counts 16 and 17 are not redundant to 14 and 15. 14 and 15 are both battery with intent, both committed on Caroline Badalon. One for using a shotgun to separate her legs forcefully, and the other for hitting her in the head when the defendants were attempting to turn her over to again commit another sexual assault. 16 and 17 are for separate batteries, one against Caroline and one against Janae, during the course of the robbery where they were hit and where both victims were hit in the head multiple times. So you've got multiple batteries, at least four different batteries occurring at four different times to different victims. These are clearly not redundant charges. The next argument made by appellant is that is 14 and 15 verses 10 through 13. And counts 14 and 15 are not redundant to 10, 11, 12, and 13. 10 is the sexual assault of Janae with the shotgun, as Justice Gibbons mentioned earlier. 11 is the attempted penetration of Caroline. 12 is the digital penetration of Janae by appellant, and 13 is the appellant holding the shotgun while Colin separately digitally penetrates Janae.
Okay, Mr. Burke, I stop you just for a minute because I know there's a lot of counts and we're trying to keep track of, but tell me specifically, and I think you've outlined it in general, why the attempted sexual assault with use of a deadly weapon is not the same as the battery with intent to commit sexual assault and the use of a deadly weapon. Why aren't they redundant?
They're not redundant because factually there are three different acts in this case. You've got the argument here is that 14, 15 are redundant to 10 and 13, and just as you point out correctly, that really 14 and 15, the victim is Caroline, and the only count between 10 and 13 that even deals with Caroline is that attempted sexual assault with a deadly weapon. And you have different acts by the defendants in this case. One where they used a shotgun to pry open her legs, which is one separate act. There's another separate act where they're attempting to turn her over during the course of the incident, and she's resisting the turnover, and they hit her in the head with the shotgun. And then third is where the appellant's hand is used to attempt to put in between her legs. And the facts are that she squeezes her legs together tightly, there's an attempt to place the appellant's fingers inside her vaginal area, but because she squeezes her legs together so tightly, he's unable to do that. So those three counts, 10, and then four, which is the attempt sexual assault, and then 14 and 15, which are the batteries with intent, are all separate acts. As to 10, 12, and 13, which appellant argues are also redundant, they're as to a totally different victim. They're as to Janae. So there's absolutely no way that they are redundant to, as to 14 and 15. And clearly 14 and 15 are not redundant as to 11, which is the attempt sexual assault that Justice pointed out. Counsel mentioned the Salazar case, which is a battery case. And in that case, it's clearly distinguishable from this case. In that case, there was a charge for battery with substantial bodily harm, where the defendant cut the victim's cut the victim, and there was some severe nerve damage. And then there was the mayhem charge, where the defendant cut the victim, and there was severe nerve damage. And the court said, you can't charge him with those two different counts for that exact same illegal act. That is clearly distinguishable from this case, where there are separate acts for every one of the charged offenses. As to the open and gross lewdness being distinct from the sexual assault or being incidental to the sexual assault, the appellant and Collins first begin to touch the women on their breasts and their buttocks. Those are the charges contained in counts 20 through 23, which are the open and gross lewdness counts. And then the facts are such that they clearly stop the activity before proceeding forward. And that's the exact language from Townsend versus State, which counsel mentioned before. They stop that activity. They then proceed forward. There's some action by them moving around the victims while the victims are lying on the ground. There's some action of them continuing to keep the four individuals on the ground. And then they move on to the action of sexually penetrating Janae and attempting to sexually penetrate Caroline. That's actually exactly on point with the court's holding in Townsend. Now, there were some counts in Townsend that the court held were incidental, but as to the fondling the victim's breast, there was the fondling the victim's breast and then the digitally penetrating her vagina, and the court held that this was a separate act of lewdness, particularly in light of the fact that Townsend stopped that activity before proceeding further, which is exactly what happened in this case. We've got touching of the breasts, we've got touching of the buttocks, we've got both defendant and both appellant and Collins moving on to different acts and then committing the sexual assaults. So it's not a situation where they are potentially rubbing the breast or the buttocks and then sexually penetrating the victims at the same time. They are two separate acts and clearly not incidental to each other. And I think that Townsend is really the case that's on point in that area. The other issue that I wanted to address just briefly, which wasn't necessarily argued before, but is addressed in the appellate's brief, is the suppression of the statement. There is some argument as to whether or not the defendant's statement was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary based upon the fact that he was on oxycodone and morphine. There was a hearing held on this issue. The state called pharmacologist David England. State also called registered nurse Jerry Dermanillion. The appellant called Dr. Johnson, who was the treating physician for the defendant. They also called toxicologist Raymond Kelly. And there are some very specific things that both sides, aren't disputed by any of the witnesses, and that's that the defendant scored perfectly on the Glasgow coma test, that he was aware and alert, that he was eating lunch, that he was alert and oriented times four, which is the question of what's your name, your date, your location. Then there was a question about who the president was. His pupils were appropriately equally dilated and reactive to light. His body chemistry was normal. There were no signs of over-medication. And appellant relies heavily on Dr. Johnson's testimony. And Dr. Johnson, who was the treating physician, he did testify at one point that a large amount of opiates in someone can cause mental status changes, is the testimony that he gave. But I'd like the court to consider what Dr. Johnson specifically said about the appellant himself. The prosecutor asked, what would you expect someone who is adversely affected by medication to a point where they couldn't communicate or understand? What would you expect them to exhibit? What sort of symptoms? And then Dr. Johnson and the prosecutor went through and laid out symptoms of hallucination, loss of memory, loss of sense of time, slurred speech, delayed responses, falling asleep, not staying alert. And then the next question from the prosecutor is, in this particular case, do you have any reason to believe, based upon your contact with the defendant, as well as your review of the medical records, that those signs or symptoms were evidenced by the period of time we made reference to February 2nd through the 4th, and the doctor testified no. So while Dr. Johnson did say that it can have mental status changes and can affect those medications, the oxycodone and the morphine can have an effect on someone's mental status, as to this defendant specifically, from his recollection and his review of the medical records, he did not find that to be the case.
Where was Mr. Castro shot?
My recollection is that he was shot, I believe, in the stomach area or the back. I think that there was, if I remember correctly, there was one shot that was more of an on point shot, and then one, and then another shot that I think grazed him in some way. But I think it was in the stomach area is my recollection of exactly where he was shot. It was a serious wound, and he did just have surgery, and he was on the medication.
How exactly was he shot, though? I know he was shot by one of the female victims, but
correct.
How did that happen?
At one point, one of the male victims was able to grab a hold of the barrel of one of the shotguns and pulled down and began to fight with one of the defendants. And at that time, he yelled out to the other male victim to help him out, and then that male victim became involved in a fight with Collins. So that first male victim is fighting with the appellant. The second male victim is fighting with Collins. The two female victims get up. One begins to try to hit appellant in the head with a frying pan. It ends up breaking. She then takes some hot water that's on the stove and throws it. It spills everywhere. Everyone's kind of sliding all around at this point. The other male victim is still fighting with Collins, the co-defendant. And in the course of that fight, actually bites off a small portion of his ear, and it ends up on the ground, and that's some evidence that's collected in the case. But finally what happens is one of the female victims, Janae, picks up one of the shotguns. There's an incident where the victim and the appellant, the fighting male victim and the appellant are kind of separated, and she ends up shooting him with a shotgun. There's a later incident where there's another attempt to use the shotgun, but it doesn't go off by one of the male victims. So it's this female victim who gets a hold of it, and in addition to that, she's actually, the only clothes she has on at that point, I think, are some socks, because her clothes have all been removed at that point by the defendants. And that's the way he ends up getting shot.
I see. Thank you.
Clearly, there are a number of issues in this case, and I haven't had time to address them all, and I apologize. But the kidnappings are the issue we talked about first. Clearly, in this case, not incidental and qualify under the Mendoza case. These are not duplicative charges. Each one is from a separate separate fact, a separate incident that occurred. And I thank the court for its time.
Thank you.
And just to address counsel's arguments in turn, again, starting with the kidnapping, I think that if we look at the prior case law, and we look at the facts of those cases, and where the kidnapping were either reversed or not, and properly stood as standalone charges, in this case, these facts have the victims merely staying in the same room. There is no movement of place to place, as the court indicated. There is no binding. There is no restraint other than that required to complete the robbery or the sexual assault. There is nothing happening besides that. Now, just to say that increases the risk of harm because they're there and because the guns are drawn and because the guns are close to them as opposed to being up top, that risk of harm is there already. What the court requires is a substantial increase in risk of harm. And on that basis, these kidnappings are nearly incidental. I mean, we're talking about cases where he received 9 to 30 years on this charges, but he's still facing the sexual assault, 16 to life. So these charges are a small part of what he's actually facing in the larger picture. Now, talking about the redundancy, I was just referring to the Blockberger case, and I apologize, by way of background, talking about how the source of this case law comes from the Fifth Amendment and about double jeopardy principles. Now, they are not, they should not stand alone, because I've already addressed the part about the open and gross lewdness as being incidental to the sexual assaults. I think it gets a little bit more tricky when we're talking about the batteries, correct? So when we're talking about count 17 involving Carolyn, that count is redundant of the attempt sexual assault. Where they're hitting her, they're trying to get her to spread their legs, and you hit her on the head, that is part of the same conduct that is happening here. So there's nothing different about it. It's part of this one single incident This one goal that the defendant and the accomplice were trying to accomplish, which was a sexual assault or to robbing them. Regarding Janae and hitting her, her count of count 17, battery with a deadly weapon, I'm sorry, count 16, that is redundant of the sexual assault. Or it could even be redundant of the robbery, count 8, because there is testimony that she was robbed and they took her purse and her cell phone. So this is, again, the state just parsing out one singular incident into discrete and small slivers of what actually happened. And that's the type of overcharging that Albitre warns us against. Finally, with regard to the statement, you know, he was in a great deal of pain. He had just recovered from surgeries. There was testimony that he was medicated, and knowing your name is not the same as making it a conscious decision to waive your Miranda right, constitutional decision. We have to think about the public policy implications of letting defendants be interrogated at the intensive care unit. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you very much. Also, we thank you for the arguments this day and the light that you shed on what was presented. These matters will stand submitted. We are back on the record at 1:30.